Carbon Sander. I teach in English and Black Studies, and I'm the current chair of the Black Studies Department. Unfortunately, I'm also the only representative of the Black Studies Department today, because it just so happened that the other two people who are going to be here with me ended up having things that they had to be at in other places today. It seems to be the world's busiest weekend. But thank you for coming, and thank you for being here. One of the things, just to give you a little bit, I wanted to spend a little time at the beginning, giving you a little bit of context about this panel and what's going on now in Black Studies. As many of you know, the Black Studies Department is going to be celebrating its 50th anniversary. We're not quite sure when, somewhere between 1969 and 1971, depending on whether you count it as the first student who came here, or the first student who graduated as a major, or the first classes that were taught, but somewhere in here, Amherst College, like most colleges actually in the nation, most of the Black Studies, Africana Studies departments were set up during that 3-year stretch. So Amherst was one of those. And some of you know, some of the early people in here, we've been talking a lot recently about Sonia Sanchez being one of the first chairs of the department. This was before my time, but when I got here in 1986, the department had reached a different kind of movement in its growth. A lot more issues of race were being discussed much more commonly in courses in American Studies and other programs, and so many people were beginning to think that maybe there was no need for a Black Studies program. And when I got here, the program was at a kind of low, and the department, the college had a big review of the program to decide whether they should keep it or let it die a quiet death. And to its credit, the college decided to try to resuscitate the department. And in order to make that happen, we have our next in order to make the department work, the college did a number of things. They asked me to join the department. I had not been hired in Black Studies. I'd been hired in English and American Studies. They made several senior hires. And they brought in a really powerful group of scholars to really rethink and reestablish the department. So in the next, I would say, 10 years after that, that is from 1986 to, you know, the early 90s, the department experienced a real rebirth in terms of the strength of its courses, the importance of its faculty, that sort of stuff. But we didn't have a lot of majors, so lots and lots of people took Black Studies classes. But there were not that many majors in the department. The big shift around that happened in the early 90s when we were joined by Professor Jeff Ferguson, who designed what became the core curriculum of the Black Studies department, which consisted of 3 courses: an intro to Black Studies, which focused on, you know, how to read, you know, sort of large, difficult books, a course on argumentation and debate, and then a third course, a research methods course. And those 3 courses together came to form the core of the Black Studies department. And as a group, they were so successful that that many students who in the past had just taken courses they liked but not majored began to decide to major. So our majors went from like 0 to about, I think at our height, we were like up to 30 or 40 or something like that. But, and you know, over the years it's fluctuated, but that moment was really important. As many of you know, we lost Professor Ferguson last year to cancer. And so that's also, you know, been another big moment of shifting and changing the department about how we're going to be a department going forward. But the 3 people we have on the panel today are all students who graduated during that period when the department was really establishing itself as a department, pulling in majors with all kinds of different backgrounds and thinking about what that major could be. So on the panel today, we have 3, they're all from the early 2000s. We have Daniel Altschulert, just to my left. He graduated in 2004, and he's a PhD. He was a triple major, don't know how you do that, and also a Rhodes Scholar, and he's now Managing Director of Make Your Own Action, a director of civic engagement and research at the same nonprofit, which I think he's been involved with. And he's also an adjunct assistant professor of public service at NYU's Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service. Sitting next to Daniel is actually Patrice. Patrice Peck, who graduated in 2009. She's not the most, she's the middle person in that group. And Patrice is a culture writer at BuzzFeed and has also published in many other places that you will recognize if you see the name. It's like, oh, I know that person. She went to school with me. Probably we saw her once, right? And then the third person on our panel is Tito Colavole, who graduated most recently in 2014 and is currently did a law degree at Columbia and is an attorney in the Global Transactions Group of the law firm Freshfields, Brookhouse, and Derringer. And it's actually based in London, so we're really glad to have her now. I'm going to start with Tito and work backwards. And really, there were two questions I asked the panelists to tell us about. One was how they decided to become a Black Studies major in the first place. And the second was how has a Black Studies major continued to inform what they've done since they left Amherst? So without further ado, Tito, it's all yours.
Hi everyone. Good to be here. So how did I decide to become a Black Studies major? So I actually came to Amherst. I didn't intend to be a Black Studies major. I told my dad, I'm Nigerian. And luckily Nigerians tend to be very kind of, doctor, lawyer, engineer types of people. I'm sure other people can relate. But I told him it's going to be history and French. And luckily my parents were pretty open and they said, okay. And then pressures of just being on a campus, I thought, you know what, let me do econ and try and be do something professional and practical, I thought. But at the same time, I was taking courses. My first year seminar was from MLK to Barack Obama. I was taking contemporary African fiction, and all the while convincing myself that I wasn't a Black Studies major. And then one time in sophomore year, I was, this is a strange story, but I was on a bus, and kind of daydreaming, and sort of had this dream where I was telling my child that Amherst, the best department at Amherst was Black Studies. And my child was like, why didn't you major in it? And I said, I don't know. And so that moment, I was like, I have to change my major. And I did, and I never looked back, and it just felt so freeing to be in a department that felt so aligned with my purpose and my talents and my interests, and was also the department that I felt was best suited to actually educate me in liberal arts and what it meant to read, write, and think. And so on that point, I'm currently an associate at Freshfields, Brookhouse Derringer. I do corporate law, specifically capital markets. And so when you see companies doing IPOs, it's lawyers in the background who are kind of producing catalogs about the risks and what that company does. And becoming a lawyer, it's funny because in law school, they would always tell you, think like a lawyer, write like a lawyer. But everything that I learned about being a lawyer came from Amherst and specifically Black Studies and not from law school. And so just having the core curriculum of Intro to Black Studies, Critical Debates, research Methods, I feel like really gave me the explicit skills that I needed to succeed. And I say explicit specifically because I was fortunate enough to take Research in Black Studies with Professor Ferguson. And he said that our goal is to make learning explicit. Mm. And I never appreciated that until I got to Columbia Law and I saw the way in which what they were telling you to do was very different from what you actually had to do to succeed. Mm. And it was oftentimes the students of color, first generation students, who lost out because of that. And so what Amherst and what the Black Studies Department was doing was so revolutionary and was something I took for granted and something that informs whatever I do, even in law. To really try and make sure that I'm seeking out the right information and reminding myself that I'm capable and how to articulate and present that information. And so it just comes up in everything I do.
I'm sorry, can you say the question again?
How did you decide to become a Black Studies major?
Gotcha.
And how do you use those skills? I'll pull over here so I can see people.
So how did I decide to be a Black Studies major? I remember in my college essay to Amherst, I had said how I wanted to become a district attorney for representing underprivileged clients from communities like the one I grew up in Bridgeport, Connecticut, like multiracial communities. And then I got here. Oh, wait, sorry. So I said I was going to do LGST and Spanish, right? So I got here and I took Foundations in African American Literature with Professor Parham and Professor Mukasa. I took his Images of African Americans in Film class, I believe. So I was just always taking a lot of interdisciplinary courses that were in the Black Studies department. And, you know, I always loved pop culture, but I never thought that there was a way to make a career out of, like, consuming it. Because, you know, I'm a movie person, TV person, music. I can talk about that all day. And so it was thanks to courses by all of the professors at the Black Study Department that I realized, oh, wow, like, I can use pop culture as a lens to talk about these deeper issues going on in the country. And that's something I always wanted to do. Like I had mentioned, I was interested in empowering people of color through law, and then I realized, okay, I actually have a passion for pop culture, but I can still help empower people through writing critically about pop culture. And so that's, you know, Black Studies was all about that. And, you know, our professors are so brilliant. And, like, in African American Literature course, I remember Professor Parham had us, like, listen, one of our assignments was, like, to listen to Khalees's Milkshake and compare the song in the video to a Zora Neale Hurston short story. I think it was about African American vernacular English or Ebonics, but just little things like that. I felt so validated in terms of my passion and interest, and I just ended up becoming English and Black Studies double major because I took so many courses that applied to both. And just like you were saying, like, I still tell everyone to this day that the Black Studies department at Amherst College is, like, invaluable. It made me the critically thinking person that I am today. It helped with my writing, like, so much. And it just made me very proud and comfortable to be a Black student in a predominantly white institution. So I'm so glad I decided to be a Black Studies major.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone, and it's very nice to be here with all of you. So my name's Daniel. I am, by way of background or unpacking some bio stuff, so I work at Make the Road New York and Make the Road Action. They're sister organizations that are the largest grassroots immigrant rights organizations and organizations with members of working class people of color in New York, and we also work across four other states. We work to build power in the communities where we work. We're a membership-based organization and work on issues everything from federal and state and local immigrant rights fights to affordable housing, to police accountability, workers' rights, and more. And I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that as we go further. But I think in terms of how I've been now doing that work, I finished grad school 8 or 9 years ago, and I've been at Make the Road for 8 years doing this work. It's been very inspiring. In terms of how this department shaped me and how I got there and how it shaped me, I arrived to Amherst. I grew up in New York City. My mother was a community organizer. So I grew up in the context of, at that point, when I was a child, she was helping to coordinate anti-apartheid divestment campaigns in New York City and around the country. And so that shaped my understanding of who I was and the importance of social justice broadly. When I first encountered the Black Studies Department, I think similar to others here and many who've engaged with the department, I was pretty sure I was going to be a political science and Spanish major. I grew up speaking both English and Spanish, and it was really important to me. But I became a Black Studies major because of Jeff Ferguson, and then visiting professor, he was only with us for 1 year, Eddie Glaude. Mm-hmm. And that was he was with us in the early 2000s, and he taught a couple courses here. And I became a Black Studies major, definitely not a professor, because they were two of the best teachers that I had at Amherst College. And that mattered, the attention and the rigor of working with folks in the department. The department was in transition mode. So what you were talking about of sort of the restructuring of the department sort of happened as I was transitioning out. But there was a lot of conversation about how to take the really strong parts of the department and create, I think, a rigorous pedagogical model that people could really embrace and strengthen the department. I did just want to say a few words about Jeff Ferguson because I think he shaped me, he shaped so many folks who went through this institution, not just the department. He was a brilliant mind who I think embodied and taught me a lot about intellectual rigor, and that was thinking harder. It was not just sort of summarizing things and giving stale analyses, but really digging deeper into and taking the next step in the analysis. I remember a paper I wrote, and he was like, "This is great. You did a really good job." And it's just, it could have been an academic paper if you just sort of, it was the Invisible Man seminar that so many of us took and loved. And he said, if you just thought about or sort of considered, or you should consider as you're reworking this, because he was very encouraging, the irony and the notion of irony in this text. And how. He was just always pushing us, even as we sort of did good work, to take the next step. He also, I think, for me and the department more broadly, made me a better writer. Mm-hmm. And by making me a better writer, a better thinker. Mm-hmm. And he spent more time, I'm sure anybody who ever had a response paper, an essay, this was like the days before track changes was really a thing. And you'd get back this paper, and it had all these notes, and he was like copying things from the Elements of Style. And it was, and he just said, you know, you are going to, there's an essay by, I think it's an Ellison essay, The Little Man at Cheehaw Station, which is, The idea here was that no matter where you are, it was, you know, you could be playing at, I think it was Cheehaw Station, I hope I'm right, it's been a while, but there might be this little man there who turns out, I can't totally remember, but the message of it was, it was a message of the importance, or part of it was about excellence and taking very seriously wherever you were, the work that you did, and striving to make it more than just an assignment. And finally, I just say, both for Jeff and the department more broadly, just a deep devotion to students. I saw a fellow 2004 grad last year who's now a professor at UC San Diego, and she was not a Black Studies major. So it talks about, I think, the impact of this department beyond its majors. And she said to me, she's told me a story of when she was grappling with applying to PhD programs and feeling like maybe she wasn't good enough or special enough. And his advice and encouragement to go forward and do it, and how transformative that was for her. So, you know, for me, I haven't had the opportunity. I wasn't here when he got sick, but I did just want to say, you know, that his passing is obviously a loss to the department, to the college, and to all of us. I have a couple takeaways that from the department's work that have influenced my work. Is it helpful to do that now, or
yeah, go ahead.
I'll just say briefly, I think. Over the course of my work or time here, one thing that one real takeaway was that white supremacy is at the heart of and in the baked into the DNA of this country. And for any of us who are, we can't forget that, and we have to face it. And that includes white folks taking it seriously, considering our privilege, whether that's outside of movement spaces or in movement spaces. And I think the work of the Black Studies Department, it informed how I then went into political science classes, for instance, or how I went into grad school. And I think, obviously, there's no moment in our country's history, well, there have been moments, but there's no recent moment where that's more on display than right now. I think the second piece was listening to the importance of listening to the stories of and voices of people who are directly affected by the issues that we work on. Story played a really central role across the department, whether it was from slave narratives or literature courses. I took an Afro-Caribbean literature course that had a lot of impact on me. And story is also at the heart of social movement work. Our work is, as a member-based organization, is all about the stories of our members and centering those as we fight to change the systems and structures that keep people down. And the final thing, I think, is, you know, Frederick Douglass once famously said that power concedes nothing without a demand. And, you know, put differently, I think my work in this department helped me understand that the arc of history may bend toward justice, but that it's much more likely to do that when people are building collective power to transform those systems and structures. And for me, that's part of why I'm part of a community organizing institution. It's why I believe that it is the theory of change to which we subscribe at the organization and the coalitions that I'm a part of. And it's shaped me a great deal.
Somehow I think it's easier for me to stand. I should add a couple things I forgot. I was thinking about
while you guys are talking. We're probably going to do a more sort of formal celebration of the department next year. But we've done, I think this is probably the third event I've been involved in that does something along these lines. So the other thing we did was in the Black Alumni Weekend, we did a panel on people from the department who've gone on to do research, and it was really interesting to hear what kinds of research people were doing. And so for this one, we wanted to think about, you know, well, what if you're going to a career outside of the academy, what kinds of things you're doing. So the work is going on at both those levels. And then the third one, which I had not actually realized was going to happen, I teach a course in the English department called Reading, Writing, and Teaching, and every year we have the class of 1954 gives honors to people who've gone into public school, into teaching, to former students and students. And in that group, there were like five or six of them who got it this year, who then came to speak to my class. And almost all of them had done Black Studies courses and talked about what they learned in Black Studies. So it felt as if, you know, we've had the research, the teaching, and now the career, the sort of outward-facing careers. And we've had three very different kinds of careers. So I'm sure some of you have things that you want to ask the panelists, or things you'd like to add to what they've said, or things you want to ask of me as a representative of the department. And so the floor is all yours. Go ahead. Yeah.
What have students been most concerned with this past year? I know that's not for these moms, but for you.
In the classroom.
Two years.
I'm trying to think about which courses I've taught in the department, you know, because I'm in two different departments. In general, I think at Amherst right now, students, there's a real huge rise in levels of anxiety. One of the most concerning statistics we got recently from the counseling department is that they say they see 40% of students at Amherst, and of those 40%, 70% of them admit to, you know, feelings around suicidal ideation. And feelings around suicide have replaced eating disorders and things like that as the most commonly expressed issue around anxiety and that sort of thing among college students. It's not just at Amherst, it's across the board. So we're getting a lot of that, and in my reading, writing, and teaching class, we have a moment where we ask students to write about moments of resistance to learning, which is a kind of play and some, you know, reading video about psychoanalytical stuff. And the thing that people wrote about most was their resistance to learning something which they felt they could not be good at. So it was everything from art to physics to environmental studies to billiards to, it was like, I've been teaching this course for 25 years, and I've never seen anything like it. People usually write about resisting being taught racism or something like that, right? But this is all about resisting learning things because their sense of their self was so tied up in the notion of having to be at the top of a certain kind of place. And so that's a really difficult thing to work with. And so it creates a huge challenge for our curriculum in Black Studies, a lot of which was focused at this business of getting students to really think about why they were reading, why they were writing, but also very, you know, everybody talks about the rigor and that sort of stuff. And now we're having to sort of think about how to package that message in a way that doesn't add to the anxieties that students are already presenting with. And so I think that's and also to get students to understand, somebody told us 2 years ago, I think, in another one of these faculty things, that this is the first, 2 years ago was the first time that the entering class had all grown up under No Child Left Behind. Mm-hmm. And so they'd all grown up in this era of super testing. And the effects of that on the way that even the best students think about education is this this feeling that you are supposed to produce the answers. I mean, students always think that, but now it's gotten to a really difficult point. And so a lot of the relearning about why is it that you learn things and what's the purpose of learning and how do you use learning and argumentation, that kind of thing, to pursue an idea that is yours, not the thing that, you know, you use what you learn to get to where you want to go to. And this year we were thinking in, you know, we were rethinking the curriculum, and we asked the majors whether they wanted to, whether they thought we should eliminate any of the core courses. And the one course that none of them wanted to eliminate was the debates course, which we were like, what? That's the worst one. In the sense of, not the worst in terms of the course, but it's a course that you think that students would think is most, you know, sort of, teaching them how to do something. But they said, students said things like, it taught me how to, I can go back now and have an argument, a discussion with my family in ways that I couldn't. It had taught me how to listen. You know, there were all these things they said. And so that movement of trying to push people back towards a way of thinking about their education is something that comes from a place that they can control is really, really, really difficult. And when I move from an English class to a Black Studies class, I feel sometimes that in the Black Studies classes, I have a basis on which to build to do that. And in the English classes, I have to do a lot more footwork in the class to get students to that point. You know, it's different kinds of learning, but I think they're both, well, all of our students are dealing with that, and so it's shifted our focus.
Yesterday, well, not a panel, but we were listening to Dr. Epstein talk about just like the future of Amherst and how the makeup of like the curriculum is happening and all these shifts in faculty and class and things of that sort. And Tito was really bragging on the Black Studies department because somebody brought up a question of, you know, it seems like Amherst is doing a lot more to teach professors how to like kind of keep up with changing pedagogy and just to scaffold more for students, and an alumni was really like concerned about what that meant in terms of rigor and the acumen of students who we accept. And so Tito pointed to the fact that like the Black Studies department is very rigorous and can be a department to look towards in terms of like how to shape the students' writing abilities here and thinking abilities and reading and all of that. And I'm wondering, I don't know if it's a panel question or not, but how the Black Studies department can work with other departments to do that was something that was brought up.
I mean, some of you talked, Patrice, you talked about looking across English and Black Studies, and you probably didn't even know which departments.
Yeah. I don't know. For just based on very, very few conversations I had with some professors who were Black, who were a part of the Black Studies department, but also in other departments. And you can tell me, you have a better experience of this, but I don't know if the Black Studies teachers and the Black teachers in particular were their input was regarded the same, or if there was any tension between people having really positive responses from being in a course of a Black Studies professor, and that just being seen as like, well, you're just popular and like kids just really like you because you're cool, as opposed to like, oh, we can actually like learn from what you're doing. So that seemed to be like a boundary that maybe was in the way, but I don't know.
I think that in the time that I've been at Amherst, the professors who taught about race at Amherst, so and not just the professors in Black Studies, not just the Black professors, mm-hmm. but you know the group of us have felt it's been a biggish group, and I think we've also felt that that our work has been valued by the institution, but a lot of that value is, you know, thank God you're doing it so that we don't have to do it. Mm-hmm. So that move, it's less about being, you know, sort of respected, and you know, we produce good work. I mean, this year we had, I think there were 11 majors, Black Studies majors this year. Four of them wrote theses in the Black Studies department. Four of them wrote theses in other departments. And between them, they cleaned up six departmental honors for the best theses, you know, across history, Black studies, women's and gender studies, theater, dance, art. I mean, you know, they just kept coming up at senior assembly for the prize. And I was like, what? That's one of ours. And so, you know, so there's that kind of thing that there's it's clear that it's not just within, you know, the Black City students seem to, a lot of them are double majors and they reach out across departments. So the rigor speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's not the issue. In fact, that's not, in the time that I've been in the Black Cities Department, that's not been the issue. The issue has been, okay, so what are other departments going to do? How are they going to supplement what we're doing and that sort of stuff? So, and that's an ongoing battle. There's actually a set of articles, if you're interested. The present, who had a fabulous Tupami student editorial board this year, and they did a series of investigative reporting on faculty of color at Amherst. So if you Google it and you look for, you know, just look for my name and, or, you know, Professor Barham, you know, Amherst student, and you see what people were saying, and they did a lot of work and they were really interested. They did like a series of three essays. So a lot of the questions that you're asking are answered very thoughtfully in that.
Okay, so this is, I guess, for everyone. So we're in a time where people believe that there are two truths, alternative facts, alternative histories, and I think something, when you start studying Black studies or African-American history, it feels like an alternative history, because up until that point, you're like, whoa, I didn't even realize all this was happening. So you guys all majored in it, and now you're out in your careers with people who did not. And so they have sometimes a different understanding of who we are as a nation, how did we get here, and how do you deal with that? Because you don't want to be the one person in your job always teaching everyone, and you're like, all right, everyone sit down, we need to have a conversation, because that becomes a load on you. But how do you navigate through that? And then also, from the standpoint of current students, has that come up, like that idea of, like, you know, what we're learning here is so different from what we've learned up to this point, or like maybe people who aren't in the department maybe like questioning some of the things that other students are learning. So.
I can go first. So before going to BuzzFeed, I actually got my first like non-college writing opportunity. I graduated in 2009 during the recession. It was very difficult to get any kind of job, you know, whether it was in media or not. And so to continue writing, I remember Googling one day, I was like, pop culture, Black girls, nonprofit. So I was like, maybe something like this exists. And Black Girls Rock came up. This is before it was like televised on BET and everything. So I like emailed, reached out to Beverly Bond. She was like, my job's looking in Philly. She was like, yeah, come by and like talk, come by to Brooklyn. So I'm like, okay. And I take a bus to Brooklyn and ends up meeting with her. She's like, yo, your resume is dope. Like, how about you contribute to our blog? And it was a WordPress blog run by one young Black woman who was about my age too, Kyle Marshall. And ended up just, you know, doing that, not being paid, but just, you know, loving the opportunity to talk about the things, like my experiences as a Black woman, and write the things that I wanted to read. And so, you know, from that point, I eventually went to grad school, maybe like 2 or 3 years later, for journalism at NYU in the Studio 20 program, which was all about disruption of journalism. And thank God I did that, because journalism is clearly being heavily disrupted. So we're learning about like what was at stake, you know, with technology, how we could use it to our advantage as journalists, things we should be on the lookout for in terms of like even teaching ourselves how to code and becoming one person shows in terms of like being able to take your own photos and video and social media and blogging and all that. And so while I was in grad school, I got opportunities to write for Ebony.com, like Hello Beautiful, that interactive one. Ended up doing an internship at Black Voices at HuffPost and The Griot at NBC. So like a lot of publications that always kept Black audiences like first and foremost. So I never had to like explain why I was pitching this story or like why, you know, X was important or Z was important. I remember when I was at Black Voices, that's when, what's his name, Tremaine, he was the first reporter to really nationally break the Trayvon Martin story. And so I was in journalism at a time when all of the Black Lives Matter movement started, and every day we were reporting on like a Black person getting shot and killed by the police and the person getting off and not going to jail. And I just remember like feeling like, okay, I don't want to write about this, but if I don't write about it, a lot of our white peers or peers who weren't Black, that wasn't necessarily their beat. We just found that no other person was really going to write about it. And so I got really burnt out from writing. I was writing for BET, OK Africa, which was all great experience, and just really being able to put like my intersectional perspective on covering all these things. And but I was like, I'm burnt out. I can't write anymore. It's a 24-hour news cycle. We're supposed to just come up with a bunch of stuff. I'm not necessarily getting paid that much. So I tried to do a Black woman beauty service startup for 2 years. And then I was like, OK, I need money to pay my bills and to eat food. And so I applied for this multicultural beauty writer position at BuzzFeed. And the objective, or listed in the job description, was like, we need someone to help us grow our Black woman audience and someone who can talk about like 4C hair texture while also talking about like the lack of representation of, you know, Asian American talent in Hollywood, just like a wide range of things. And so I applied for that, ended up getting it. BuzzFeed is a predominantly white, it's interesting because I think Forbes or one of those top publications has said recently, like last year, BuzzFeed is in like the top 10 of the most diverse companies in the world, or in the country rather. And it is like statistically, but obviously I think a lot of people, you know, can relate when I say it's different just being in a predominantly white workplace where you do find yourself having to sometimes advocate for yourself, advocate for your peers, advocate for diversity and inclusion, and having to, you know, BuzzFeed's a startup, so a lot of these things weren't even baked in to the institution. We're still figuring out a lot of these things, but you know, it's just very stressful. And so it's great because there are a lot of like other Black colleagues at BuzzFeed who we share the same desires in terms of wanting to like protect our mental space, in terms of not feeling like we have to humanize ourselves or explain things about our culture XYZ, and also having to enforce this idea of like rejecting like invisible labor, which we do so much of. And so it got to the point where, you know, now I'm comfortable explaining that to my manager or colleague. That's because when I came onto BuzzFeed, I had a Black woman manager who was down too, like, you know what I'm saying? So it's just been like, it's something I'm still dealing with. So
let me see if I said, don't know if either of you want to go.
I like what you said about sometimes what we've learned is considered alternative facts, and I think that's just it. Recognizing that the history, the humanities, the everything that we've learned is just a Eurocentric narrative based on who won. And I think that is in law school is just so conservative and horrible in that aspect. And it's really scary when you see that the people who are going to be the next generation's future policymakers, that they are getting zero of this education. And I was just telling my friend over there that I was in a criminal law class, and they were talking about a case of a white man who shot some Black youth who came up to him and tried to get $5 from him and then ran away when he was like, no, don't take my money. They ran away and he shot them repeatedly as they're running away on the subway. Claimed self-defense. Of course, he got off. It was fine. This was in the 80s.
And then in that same class, they talked about the concept of reasonable racism that some scholar came up with, that basically if the statistics are there, that this group is disproportionately represented in criminality, in the criminal justice system, it makes sense that someone would have that bias and therefore feel fear and then take matters into their own hands and do what they did. And so I was sitting in a room of about 100 people who were just kind of sitting there letting that marinate and nodding. You know, and I was shaking, and I was like, what's going on? And luckily, I remember one of the black professors said that, you know, sometimes you just need to speak up, even if you're shaking, even if your voice is just left, and just say it. And so identifying those gaps. And then I raised my hand, and I said, well, that would be like me shooting a loner white boy in a classroom, because I'm scared he's going to shoot up the school. The statistics are there. And then finally, and people were like, you know what? That's true. And came up to me after. And they came up to me, they're like, thank you. Like, that's it, you know? And I feel like that moment really showed me how it's really about kind of identifying those gaps where we can kind of insert narratives, you know? And it's not going to be all the time. And Patrice, your point about like finding the community is so important for the mental health. Seeking out the people on the same terms with you and who get you. But then when those gaps are there, I think it's important if you're able to just kind of penetrate and use your education and speak truth and enlighten people. And even if it's in simple ways, like I've been in my firm's Black Lawyers Association, and I had an event about this Nigerian lady who does documentaries in different African countries. And so she came, showed her episode on Nairobi and everything going on in terms of tech, fashion, innovation. And people's minds were blown. This was in New York. And we're just saying, whoa, we didn't even know that we didn't know anything about Africa. Mm-hmm. And we're like, and people came up to me, you need to show this in schools. This is crazy, you know. And even down to things like we serve Nigerian food there. Mm-hmm. And people are like, I didn't even know what African food was like. What do they eat? And so I just think like using all those opportunities, even if they seem trivial, even if you're scared, and speaking and inserting yourself in the room and interrupting.
I think I think on the topic of interrupting, so like, I mean, I come at this as a different, from a different perspective as a white man. But I mean, two things. First, I think there's just a working in spaces of white people. The organization where I work is mostly people of color, but often am presenting and in spaces of white people. And I think being willing to interrupt and to call out white supremacy when, you know, when we're having these conversations in those audiences is important. I can remember instances of needing to do that or feeling kind of compelled to do it at Amherst College in political science classes, like talking about the first half of the 20th century and without any mention of racial terror or lynching. And it was like, you know, if we don't understand what's going on, to now being in other spaces or engaging with people in, I do a lot of communications work for our organization, so engaging with reporters or in those types of spaces. I also think I work at an organization, again, that is we have 23,000 members in New York. They are predominantly Latino immigrants and younger people of color of different backgrounds, so Latino, African-American, and other backgrounds. And I think there is a range, even within our membership and our staff, it's something that we organizationally are grappling with, about of political education and awareness of some of this stuff, because people didn't have the privilege of having some of the education that folks in this room did. And so we take organizationally political education really seriously, not as one-time. You know, we've come to recognize that, you know, one-time workshops are not sufficient to undo what is a really pernicious socialization and education that many people have had. And people are coming from, in our organization, dozens of different countries and with dozens of different prejudices at any moment. And so, you know, I think we're trying organizationally to work on how do we make sure that anti-blackness that we're taking on anti-blackness directly. We're taking on, for instance, prejudices that exist within a lot of our Latino membership, preconceptions about race, gender. We are also, a lot of our members are transgender immigrants, so also grappling with some of those, with the prejudices towards that community. And so No, I think, and it's not, we're not alone among social justice organizations that I know in trying to say, look, we're going to go out into the world and spread this message of equality and inclusion and how we can build power together, we have to do the work, invest in doing the work internally, and it's hard.
I don't know where we are for time. I think we
were just there.
Yeah, we're just there. So I don't know if anybody has. So maybe we should stop so that people can come and continue the conversation less formally. Something that you one of the things that you remind me of, all of you talking, is about how in the recent years in Black Studies we've been able to, we're really just beginning to really foreground issues of gender, sexuality, trans issues, and that sort of stuff. And how that. How our own, we're really having been pushed by our students to rethink our curriculum in terms of those issues of gender and sexuality. And it's created some really interesting new conversations in the department about who's your canon, how do you talk about these things. So that's another thing. For those of you who wanted to know what's new, that's another new, well, not new, but, rather than, again, individual classes on these matters, but having that as part of the identity of the department. So that's been a big thing for us too. Thank you for coming. Please stay in touch.